Hey everyone, and welcome to the Science Bloggers Podcast. I'm David Latchman, and thank you for joining me for this episode. This episode was recorded on April 2nd, 2020, so some things may have changed since then. This week's guest is Wes Wilson, and if that name sounds familiar, it's because Wes is a returning guest. Yeah, he has been here before. Wes's field of research is cancer, specifically in using the immune system to fight certain types of cancer. So check out his previous episode if you can. When the SARS-CoV-2 pandemic started, I wondered, what was its impact on scientific research? For some scientists like Jake Schreber, who I interviewed in a previous episode, it's been pretty much business as usual. The same can't be said for all scientists, some of whom have seen the research grind to a halt as they shelter at home. For people like Wes, much of their research takes a form of clinical trials, so there has been an impact, as many of the participants in those studies are immunocompromised. But it's not all bad news, as you will discover when you listen to this episode. Scientists, in fact, many people in general, have stepped up to do what they can to fight this pandemic, and that is truly inspirational. I hope you learn a lot from what Wes had to say, because I know I did. So, hello Wes, how are you doing?
I'm quite well, David. How are you?
I'm good, as expected. As we are recording this, we're under the COVID-19 pandemic. So I think, as with anyone, we are all doing well, but not so well at the same time, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's a scary time all over, I think. Global pandemic. So that's to be expected, I guess.
It is. It's a very uncertain time. So how are you doing?
I think I'm doing the best that any of us can do. So for those who don't know, I'm a cancer researcher. So I am dealing with, I worked with and alongside clinical trials for cancer patients. The hospitals right now are kind of insane. It's a war zone in there. Everyone's just kind of just doing their best. The protocols are changing daily, if not hourly, on how to respond, how to handle the increased patient flow, how to deal with the lack of equipment, the running out and shortages of PPE, almost at the hospital level. These are not, generally speaking, large guidelines that are being followed at state or provincial levels. These tend to be on a hospital per basis level, trying to cope the best they can. Not always, I think, as many people have probably seen in the media, not all of these guidelines and protocols given out by the hospitals have been good, and not all of them have been safe. So some of the stuff has been telling nurses and physicians and other healthcare workers to follow practices that, if they had done this in 2019, they would have been fired for their job for like the kind of personal protection equipment wearing. And that might expose other patients to other patients' diseases. And so it's interesting time. I think everyone's doing the best they can. And I hope that all of our healthcare systems around the world can cope with this global pandemic.
Yeah, I hope the same thing too. I think the biggest problem is that there's no sense of leadership telling people exactly what needs to be done, right? Yes, we know it's a pandemic. We know that things are going to be changing on the fly, pretty much. But, people just aren't being updated. And I guess that has a lot to do with the piss poor global leadership that we have right now. So,
yeah, I mean, I think some countries are definitely doing better than others. I wouldn't say the whole world has poor leadership. France was very, very early to start cutting social events. The Paris Marathon was one of the first large events I remember being canceled for COVID-19 in a country that didn't have, at the time, a huge outbreak. Obviously, Japan did very well. They closed their schools. They had, most of their patients were on that cruise ship, as you remember, to begin with, but they were already, they knew from epidemiological studies, they had a good outbreak control team. They were already shutting down their schools for 2 months just to prep to be safe. in February. And like, that's, you know, some governments have responded quite well. Some governments, because of the international world we live in, it can be harder. You look at the testing that like Singapore was doing, amazing testing numbers compared to the United States, where it's abysmal levels of testing were done in the early days. You know, some countries aren't doing that poorly, I would say. I think you do get issues in Europe where you can't stop certain types of travel. And if you look at Canada, the United States, you know, we share the longest undefended border in the world. You're not going to be able to really stop that kind of transport either. They have closed down a lot of those borders to help stop it, but there's so much. People are dual citizens. There's so many Canadian American dual citizens. There's so many people who live in Canada but work in the States. People who work in the States but live in Canada, and they commute every day across the border. You know, downtown Windsor is a 5-minute drive to downtown Detroit, Michigan, from Windsor, Ontario, Canada. So, you know, it's so intertwined. You can't really cut that down. And Canada has done, you know, all things considered, quite a good job. Not the best job, no, but comparatively quite good. The United States, have they done the worst job? Maybe not, but comparatively pretty bad. And when you like neighbor each other so closely, it hurts the other country doing better, because they can do all the things they want to do, but if the Americans don't follow suit, then it's going to get out there.
Yeah, I think, you know, it doesn't just affect us at a country level. It also affects us on the state level, at least here. So not all governors, not all state governors have, you know, mandated a stay-at-home order, right? And that is...
Which boggles my mind. Boggles my mind at this point in the game.
Yeah. And I think the biggest thing this administration has missed is that with a disease knows no borders, right? It doesn't think, oh, well, it's being contained in this town in Michigan, so I'm gonna like go somewhere else. You know, it doesn't quite work that way.
Right.
And
COVID doesn't care about states' rights.
That's true, exactly. So I don't know, it's just a little frustrating to see all of this play out on the news. As a science communicator, you're also frustrated because so much of science has been, its funding has been cut, and we don't listen to experts, even especially when we should. So it's just kind of like, I don't know. I don't know how you feel about it.
I mean, the States, like no other, has rejected science and experts to a level where they are... There's a good chunk of the population that is proud to rebel against it. That it is an American thing to say, no, we're not going to listen to the experts. We're going to do it the American way, and we are going to triumph because we're Americans. And that is quite a unique stance. We did see a rise in that over the last couple of years in other nations, of course. What I would be interested to see, just from a science communication policy, since this is a science communication podcast and we shouldn't just be talking medicine the whole time, is... Will that change when this is over? Will we still be in this world where, in the pre-Brexit world, where people were on television saying, you know, the public is tired of experts? Will this event kick people back and be like, hey, experts, scientists, maybe they know what they're doing. Maybe we should be listening to them. And will that change going forward how we talk about other global issues like climate change? And even healthcare for all from the United States, will this be something that pushes people to be like, oh my God, we do need healthcare for everyone. Will this be that way? I don't know if you saw this in the news. It was that the 17-year-old boy in Los Angeles who died essentially because he didn't have health insurance. Did you hear about that one?
I have not heard about that one, but you know, I wouldn't be surprised if that has happened.
Yeah. So he was a healthy boy, 17 years old. He got diagnosed with COVID-19. Things escalated. Now, we don't know if he died from COVID-19. He might have died from other something else, some other co-infection or some other thing, some other complication. It may not be a COVID-19 related death, but he did have COVID-19. He was healthy before, and as his symptoms escalated and got worse, he got turned away from hospital because he didn't have health insurance to cover it. It doesn't matter what the thing was that killed him. What really killed him was lack of access to healthcare.
Last week, I interviewed the host of The Patient Will See You Now. It's a podcast. He's a junior doctor, and he interviews people with certain medical conditions, and he talks about their experiences. And during our talk, we were saying, like, your experience with one disease might be completely different to mine because of economic circumstances, right? I may not be able to afford the medical care, so as a result, I don't do what's necessary, and that might impact my care and recovery, or I might even die from it, right? And I think what we see with COVID-19 is that some people are going to be disproportionately affected than others, and is going to cross racial and economic lines. And that is like the worst part of it all. It's some people are going to come out pretty fine, and a lot of people are not.
It's true. And then we see that for across almost all disease states, that lower social economic status, especially in the states where access to healthcare is the divide is much greater between the rich and poor, that they do poorer. And part of that is because you don't seek care as early. And I try to tell this to people. People just don't seem to get it in their heads. But if going to the hospital means you don't get to pay rent, then you might not go when your symptoms get bad. You might wait and be like, oh, it'll get better. I've had bad flus before. It'll get better. And you rough it out until you don't get better. And by the time you do go to hospital, it's too late. And that is a huge impact for many diseases. It has to do with, you know, even diabetes patients who don't have access to healthcare. Many of the symptoms they'll put off until it gets so bad that it interferes with their day-to-day life, right? With diabetic retinopathy and the loss of vision, you know, the vision will be going, and then it gets so bad that they can't do their job. Then they go to the doctor, and at which point, you know, there's nothing they can do. You maybe get an eye transplant, put yourself on the list, but you're out of commission until then. It's such a painful thing to watch because we have the knowledge on how to treat these diseases. We have the skill sets. We have highly trained, skilled physicians and nurses and healthcare professionals within the Western world. And there's no reason why we can't help these people, except that we've chosen in the States a profit motive above a life. That isn't to say that outside of the United States that systems are perfect. They're not perfect. There's no system that's 100% perfect. But there's a lot better than what's currently happening in America.
Yeah, and you know, unlike diabetes, if someone gets diabetes, they're not going to transmit that condition to someone else. But with SARS-CoV-2, yeah, you're going to transmit that to someone else. And if we don't take care of the most vulnerable amongst us, you know, that's a problem. That's a threat that's always constantly looming. So you may have all the money to take care of yourself, but you know what? That disease is going to be right around your door, and it's going to get you at some point in time. And we have to acknowledge that.
It's true. And it's, oh my God, it's insane for cancer as well. You know, like 62% of cancer patients go into debt from their treatment. Another 3% of that have to file for bankruptcy. People are losing their homes because they get cancer. And as someone who works in cancer, it's an amazingly painful thing to watch because they're dealing with so much already. There's so much emotions that come with getting a cancer diagnosis. There's so much burden on patients and patients' families and caregivers from a cancer diagnosis. And when you add in the financial burden and then the idea that you might become homeless from this disease, I'll start crying if I keep talking about it. I hate it.
Yeah, I know exactly how you feel. I mean, I mean, I'm not working in it, and I hate it as well. You know, the very thought that you can lose everything from, you know, a disease that is not your fault. It has nothing to do with you. You just have this. So you're in cancer research.
I am. So I didn't get an intro, but I'll introduce myself a little bit better here. For those who don't know, my name is Wes Wilson. I just completed a big chunk of cancer research in mesothelioma in Perth, Western Australia, the University of Western Australia, and at NCARD, part of the National Asbestos Disease Related. I've screwed up the acronym, but NCARD. I started in pediatric brain tumors back in 2010 at the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto, Canada. I'm originally Canadian. And I stayed in pediatric tumors for quite a while and began working on them more when I moved to Australia to work with pediatric brain tumors there at the Telethon Kids Institute. But then I transitioned into adult cancers, into mesothelioma, because I was very interested in immunotherapy. And so immunotherapy is this new front line. It's a broad term for these new kind of exciting new treatments that use the body's own immune system to fight the cancer. And there's lots of types of immune therapies. Some of these things are vaccines. Vaccines are a type of immunotherapy because you're getting the body's immune system to do something. Cancer vaccines have always been the holy grail of cancer research, as it were. But there's some new stuff on the plate. So people have been working on those for decades. But some of the new stuff is things like checkpoint blockade therapy, which is about turning off the body's ability to recognize self. You don't want your immune system to attack itself normally, because that's how you get an autoimmune disease. That's lupus, that's, you know, arthritis, that's diabetes. So there's a whole bunch of systems in play to stop you from attacking yourself, and to get the immune system to attack cancer cells. And cancer cells, if you remember, are your own cells. We have these things called checkpoint blockade inhibitors, and they basically temporarily give you this sort of autoimmune disease kind of state where your immune system can attack its own self and therefore enable it to attack cancer cells. If you want to learn more about that, there's a YouTube video that I did on that. You can Google Wes Wilson cancer. It should be the first hit. I talk a lot about checkpoint therapy in that one. So if you're interested in that one, you can go work on that. Look at that video. But currently, I've moved on to a new type of immunotherapy. This is my new position at the University of Pennsylvania. I'm co-split my time, so I'm 75% part of the immunobiology and experimental pathology group, and I'm 25% with the pulmonary oncology group and critical care division. And what we're working on there is something called CAR T cell therapy. Have you heard of CAR Ts, David?
No, I have not. What is it?
CAR Ts are really cool, and they've really exploded in the last 5 years for blood cancers like B-cell lymphoma and so forth. But what we're trying to get them to do is get them to work for multiple myeloma, which is another blood cancer that originates in the bone marrow. So CAR T-cells, T-cells are an immune cell. They're found in your body. They're the type of cells that recognize foreign invaders and kill them off. They're called cytotoxic T-cells. There's a great Netflix series called Cells at Work that actually stars some of these lymphocytes and some of these T cells, and it's a really good show. Have you seen that show?
No, but I'll check it out tonight.
Add it to your list. I recommend people check it out. It's a great show. If you have any kind of biology background, you'll find a lot of the inside jokes funny. But if you don't have a biology background, the show is still really entertaining and actually quite educational. So add it to your list. Add it to your watch list. We're all stuck in COVID-19 isolation. We need more Netflix shows to watch. It's called Cells at Work. Check it out. Anyway.
I mean, what are you going to do?
What else are you going to do? Listen to some podcasts. And I'll give you some recommendations for some good podcasts at the end of this interview, I promise. And yes, they are all mine. So T cells, back to CAR T cells. So you get a patient, you take their blood, you sort out all the cells. There's lots of cells in the blood. There's like red blood cells, white blood cells, you know, all the stuff, platelets, serum, good stuff. And you filter out just their T cells. Okay. So you take their T cells and you put them in a Petri dish. Then you transfect them, and by that I mean you put in a gene inside the T cells that codes for a receptor that can hunt down the cancer cells. And we do this, there are many strategies for putting genes inside of other cells. CRISPR-Cas is CRISPR-Cas13 is a popular one, but you can still use other things like older technology like lentiviruses. And so most of the stuff is done with reprogrammed lentiviruses, and the viruses infect the cells and they put the gene that you've coded in the virus into the human cell. So you put in that receptor, then you basically put in some media, and there's usually a gene in there that codes for if the gene was taken up or not. And you select out all the T cells that weren't coded, didn't get the gene. So now all you're left with is these T cells that you've reprogrammed that have a gene and a receptor that can target cancer. And then you give them a bunch of hormones and media, and you grow up like millions of them. And then you inject those back into the patient. The patient doesn't reject this cell therapy because it's their own cells. You've reprogrammed their own T cells. Those T cells circulate around the body, hunt down and kill the cancer. And normally you don't need many treatments of this because T cells themselves can proliferate. They can multiply on their own. So a lot of patients will only ever need one treatment, especially in some of the leukemia studies. And some of the other ones, multiple myeloma, some of the other trials, sometimes they need two, in rare cases, three. But still, once is theoretically enough if we get the protocols down well. And we're seeing really, really good responses to cancers we haven't been able to successfully treat, or cancers that have been, that have escaped. One of the early ones, the CD19 CAR T cell therapy used for leukemia, for example, had like an 80% response rate, which is fantastic. In the United States, however, it is a very expensive treatment. I think the last CD19, so I'm not doing CD19, I'm doing a different molecule, but I remember the CD19 treatment in 2019 or 2018 was $500,000 for treatment in the United States. So a great treatment, 80% response rate, but not exactly accessible or affordable to most Americans.
Wow, that wouldn't be accessible to many Americans.
No, but it's a cool technology. It's a very exciting area of cancer research for sure. It hasn't had great success in solid tumors yet, but people are working on that while we keep pushing the boundary for more and more blood cancer.
Wow. So with COVID-19, how has it affected your research so far? And I guess the research of your colleagues.
So it's a very interesting question. So it's affected us in two main ways. I guess the first is when it comes to clinical trials, the cancer trials are sort of slowing down. We can't recruit as many people into them. And many trials have stopped recruitment around the nation. And this is to do with the fact that the number one risk factor from the Chinese death data for COVID-19 is cancer patients. Now, I'll do an asterisk in saying that cancer generally is a disease of the elderly. So there is some comorbidity stats there with being older. Like over 75 was already a risk factor for mortality of COVID-19. But cancer patients have an even higher risk and considered the highest risk. So limiting the amount of times patients need to come into the hospital decreases their risk of catching COVID-19. There's a higher chance for a cancer patient to get COVID-19 if they're going into the hospital more and more, which is why if you're actively seeking treatment, you really, really have to be careful as a cancer patient right now. If you've been in regression for 2 years and you haven't had treatment in a while, then you probably don't have much to worry about unless you were a patient that had like a bone marrow transplant and you're considered immunocompromised for a while. But otherwise, if you're going in for radiotherapy, surgery, chemo, every time you go in, you're putting yourself at risk for exposure. And those treatments themselves can cause decrease your immune system's response. It can weaken your immune system, making you immunocompromised. And so those are things we're watching out for. So for clinical trials versus someone who's not in a clinical trial, there might be more monitoring. So a patient with a lung cancer, for example, if they're on a clinical trial, they might be coming in for more CT scans of their chest, more chest x-rays more often, so we can monitor the progression of the treatment. However, that's a bad thing to be doing right now. Not to mention a lot of elective surgeries are being postponed to decrease the risk of COVID-19 to everyone. So that has really impacted a lot of clinical trial research in that regard. But the other thing that I guess is taking away our time is that everyone is all hands on deck COVID-19. So you are seeing ophthalmologists helping out in internal medicine. You're seeing people, you know, doctors volunteering from other departments to help take blood in the ER so the nurses can focus their time on the things that nurses do best, and nursing people back to health without having to, you know, just do the little tasks that doctors can do. It's very important to understand that doctors are not trained to be nurses, but there is some overlap in skills, like taking vitals, like taking blood, things that they can do to help out ER nurses. They're in there doing that. One of my bosses right now, actually, I guess I'll say his name, Michael Malone, he's at Penn Experimental Biology, at Penn, at UPenn. He has just been recruited to help lead a new COVID-19 clinical trial that's going to start on Monday. I don't know how much this is hush-hush, so I don't actually know how much we're supposed to talk about this, but I'll talk about things that aren't too, since I've already said something, I'll just carry on that. But it's a hydroxychloroquine clinical trial. It's going to start on Monday for COVID-19 in Philadelphia. And one of the things that people don't really know is that hydroxychloroquine, you know, people have been talking about these drugs in terms of parasite biology, how these were treatments for malaria. But there's actually experimental biology already using these compounds in cancer. So some of these cancer researchers are already experts in these compounds that they want to use experimentally for COVID-19. So they're being recruited to help with this clinical trial design and how to dose it and how to treat with it. You know, cancer people are not infectious disease experts, but everyone has little tools that have crossover and everyone's being recruited and pulled in. You know, computational biologists and bioinformaticians, they are leaving their work and they're getting pulled into COVID-19 studies for drugs, for doing high throughput drug screening, using machine learning to try to figure out what kind of compounds and what kind of drugs might be effective for COVID-19. Everyone is being pulled into this thing. Like I said, it is a war out there, and we're all on the same team, and we're all fighting together. And so that has also put a block, a pause, a hindrance, if you will, on our traditional cancer clinical trial framework. And I think that, and I don't know this to be true, but I believe that would be similar across all fields of medicine. I can only speak for cancer research, but I would believe that many areas are being the resources reallocated to this crisis.
So, you know, just a few points. You know, we don't think about the effects of this has on our medical system, that other people are going to be either denied treatment or their treatment is going to be delayed, even if they have something that's not COVID-19 related. And, you know, that's something people need to be aware of. But, you know, on the research side, you know, when we start looking at cancers and parasites and, you know, all these wonderful things, this is just me as someone on the outside looking in who really doesn't have a biology background. I'm always fascinated that, you know, the ways organisms hijack, you know, our immune systems, you know, they use similar methods. So someone who's doing research in parasites might find common ground in someone who's doing research in cancer. And that might help us fight, you know, people who are dealing with COVID-19.
So, oh, for sure. Lots of crossover.
So, you know, it's good that so many people are stepping up to the plate and doing what they can. And I think everyone is our heroes for that, you know, not just the medical personnel who put their lives at risk, but, you know, everyone who's contributing their skill set and their knowledge and their experience. And I guess that's what makes it so frustrating as well, because in the past few years, funding for science has just been slashed. You know, we have just been cutting it down. And we are seeing why it's so important now. And I hope we realize that we need to invest more. You know, it's very frustrating.
Yeah. And to watch how much, and I guess just to watch how much we've done cuts in the past as well. Whoops, sorry. Yeah. As I bang everything over here. Yeah, I mean, we cut everything and then everything falls apart and a crisis happens and we're like, how did this happen? And it's like, well, we cut all the funding. So,
yeah.
I mean, it's interesting because, like, I was having a conversation with my buddy Chris the other day about this. And you're listening, you can check out Chris's Random Acts of Kindness channels. I think he's on Instagram and YouTube and stuff. He does some cool stuff. And we were talking about how who the heroes are going to be portrayed as when this is over. And you're definitely seeing social media, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. You know, the first people are definitely pointing to are the physicians, especially some of these doctors in America where in New York, where they're clearly overrun. And I think it's easy then to extrapolate that to physicians and nurses in Italy their healthcare system was overrun. But there's other people, and there's people who are risking themselves to go to work outside of medicine, but are helping medicine. So right now, masks, for example, we can't get enough masks. We can't get them in fast enough. And, you know, as you said, you're in the States, the governors there are getting no aid from the federal government. So they are ordering directly from China, and they're getting orders put through from China. Meanwhile, people in China are going to work, and they are working their asses off to make masks to save America. And will Americans remember that while they're at home, you know, complaining that they have to watch another episode of Netflix because they can't go to the park, that there's people in China making masks to save them right now? Will all these other unsung heroes, the people who really are stopping this from becoming worse than it could be, because it's bad right now, don't get me wrong, and we have not yet hit the apex of how bad this will be, but it could be so much worse if it wasn't for the hard work of so many unsung heroes. And I'd love to hear your thoughts, David. Like, who else do you think deserves some praise for putting themselves at risk to help us?
Well, that's a difficult question because, you know, so many of these stories don't get told. You know, there's so many people that are essential to this fight. So it's just like people who man stores so that you can get groceries, people who make sure that, you know, your trash is taken away. Because we don't want that to pile up. Because if that piles up, then we have a new disease vector that can wipe us out as well. You know, I don't know. It's there's so many people that are doing so much work right now. You know, that I really think that they need a shout out or acknowledgement that what they're doing is positive. We need them. So many people are putting their careers on hold, their work on hold just to do the research necessary to save people's lives. You know, it's mind-blowing. I don't know. I don't know who to thank. I have to thank, like, a lot of people. That's all I know.
Yeah, me too. I'm fortunate. I'm fortunate that I am here where I am in the country that I am in. During this crisis, I know that it's worse than other places. I know that there are comforts that I get to enjoy by being where I am. I have access to high-speed internet. So I can do some work. I can do help. I can do this show with you right now. We're recording right now. I'm glad that it's not negative 40 winter time, that this is happening now in spring. You know, I know that I am fortunate, and there are people who are in other parts of the world who are trapped because they were traveling. The countries they're in are great countries with great healthcare systems, but they aren't from that country, and their access to resources and money and healthcare is limited. I know that we had several people who were overseas doing field work, who all of a sudden the borders are closing and flights are being canceled, and they are now trapped in these countries, and they're fine countries. They're great countries. I sound like Trump there. The best countries. But they aren't from there. They don't have access to those healthcare systems necessarily, or if they do, at a great financial cost. Like I said, I'm very grateful that I happened to get trapped when the borders did close, that I got trapped where I am. And so I'm grateful for that.
It's a very uncertain time. You know, a lot of people, you know, have no idea how to deal with a lot of these issues. You know, they're placed in situations that it's beyond their control. And I hope when this is over that we look back and we fix things, and we truly fix things, you know, and hope, you know, this doesn't happen again, you know, and it shouldn't have happened in the first place. You know, we have the means, we have the technology to monitor these things to prevent it. And I'm not saying like it's going to be perfect. Yes, one or two, you know, diseases is going to get away from us, but we can get the majority of them. And a couple of years ago when we had the SARS virus, that, from what some people were saying, could have been a pandemic, but we managed to monitor it and it didn't.
Well, yeah, containment. I mean, so the big thing with SARS and what we've learned since the SARS outbreak is, you know, these kind of things, you have to contain them. If they escape containment, that's when... Can I swear on your podcast? What's your rating?
Well, it's always you can bleep it, but I can add the explicit tag.
You can bleep it later. That's when shit hits the fan, is when you lose containment. And we did an amazing job with SARS and we contained it. It did not escape containment. So, yes, there was a lot of deaths, but we contained the outbreak. For COVID-19, we lost containment from today's date, a long time ago. But we did lose containment. We weren't able to contain it. And some countries did better at trying to contain it within their country. But once it's lost containment anywhere, it's kind of really hard to put that back in the jar. That being said, I don't know. Like, yes, many countries did not handle this well. But I don't know if we ever would have been able to contain COVID-19. COVID-19, the symptoms are so varied. They're so inconsistent between patients. They are so inconsistent in their, not only the presentation of the symptoms, but the severity of the symptoms. This would have been a very hard virus to contain like we did with SARS, because you would have had people who wouldn't have known they were really sick still not being isolated like we did with SARS. With SARS, people, you knew you had SARS. So I think, especially what we're seeing with the children, right? And this was brought up by, this is not my own analogy, but I love using it. It's from a pathologist in Alberta who kind of talks about the children. That's one of the first early cases in China that we noticed was so many children weren't getting the disease. And this led some healthcare authorities to think that children were safe and that we didn't need to worry about children, because you talk about the high risk populations, right? It's going to be people who are older, people who've had exposure to someone with COVID-19, right? People who are traveling, and children were considered so low risk that they weren't being tested. And so that's the wrong message. And so what this pathologist from Alberta, whose name I can't remember, but hopefully maybe I'll email you, you can put his name in the show description so I credit him properly, is he kind of compares it to like the Hound of the Baskervilles, the Sherlock Holmes, where it's the hound that doesn't bark that gives it away. Because we don't know that if these non-symptomatic children, are they not getting infected? Or are they getting infected but show no symptoms, which means they can keep spreading it? Because we know this to be true for the flu, right? The flu symptoms are less severe in children. We know this about some other respiratory viruses. So could this be the similar case in COVID-19? And if that is the case, then we were probably never going to contain COVID-19, even under the best of situations. Does some countries' poor response make things worse? Absolutely. Did it increase the death toll? Absolutely. If you look at the death rates between countries, you can definitely see that in the stats. But I don't think we were ever going to contain this one.
Yeah, that what you said makes sense. But you know, with SARS, at least from my understanding of it, it's that afterwards it was over, basically most of the research stopped. And, you know, you just wonder, because, you know, it's a related virus, if I'm getting it correct, if I understand it correct.
Yeah.
You know, that research might have helped. I don't know. Could have, maybe. We don't know. So it's like frustrating. I keep saying that over and over.
It is frustrating. I mean, I do want to give some shout outs to some groups of people who keep working on it. There's a group in Chapel Hill in the United States who've been working on SARS and MERS and SARS related viruses since the outbreak. And they've been working with a drug company out of California called Gilead, I believe, which, of course, now when I hear that name, I only think of Handmaid's Tale. But
yeah,
but they've had a drug that's been very, very good in the preclinical setting. So in mice, with these type of viruses. And they have just started up, because of the outbreak, a clinical trial in China with their drug. I don't know any of the results from that clinical trial yet. I think it's too early to know anything. But they're definitely, people since SARS have been working on those types of things in case another SARS came back. A big thing, and this is kind of where I'm quite proud of my home country of Canada, is since SARS, which they handled amazingly, in my opinion, and again, I sound like Trump every time I say that, but they did a really, really good job of containing SARS. But since then, they have learned from their response to get even better. And they have learned from epidemiology studies, they've learned from containment protocols, how to handle things and do things better. Now, every hospital has a protocol and a way to do things. And one of the things we saw with the United States is that they cut and fired in 2018 their pandemic response team. And that's the opposite direction, right? You couldn't pick two countries going in different directions. And so it's sad to see that. But in some ways, a lot of other countries have learned and moved on and used this stuff from SARS to make what we're seeing now with COVID-19 not as bad as it could be because of the lessons we did learn from SARS.
Well, I guess it's good that other countries have done better. So that is certainly optimistic. It's kind of like not so optimistic when you watch the news, especially on the US side of things. So it's heartening to hear that other countries have, yeah, we have learned from SARS and we are actually doing better, even though, you know, we're in the situation that we are in right now. So that's good to hear.
It's weird to see, I think, the news. Oh my God, the news, right?
The news.
One of the things, if you look at the news in Australia and the news in the United States, which are the news that I've been watching the most, with the exception of Canada, this response shouldn't be a political issue, but they've turned it into it. They've put money and economics ahead of people's lives so that rich people don't lose too much money. They're willing to risk the lives of non-rich people. Like Australia, you can like still go get a haircut. So at first, the first restrictions were that you could only get haircuts if the haircuts were like only 30 minutes or less. But then like all these people complained saying that like, they couldn't get a haircut. The way their hair was cut, they couldn't do it in 30 minutes. So then they removed those restrictions. And meanwhile, other countries are all like, all right, no, every non-essential service, you're closed now. We're telling you, you're closed. And meanwhile, Australia is like, it could hurt the economy if we close hairdressers, so no. But you're not standing 1.5 meters away from someone when you're cutting their hair. That's not social distancing, right? That's like... I mean, maybe if you had some sort of like claw-like thing. You ever have one of those claw things as a child? You could reach out with a mechanical claw and pick things up. Maybe if you're cutting hair like that.
Yeah.
Maybe, but that doesn't seem likely.
Yeah, it's crazy that, I don't know, I don't want to sound harsh. I don't want to blame people, you know, but the extent that people are going to circumvent these rules, even if it's they're in denial, is just mind-blowing. Because I've also read reports where people have like mobile hairdressing stations where they go to clients. And
oh, right. Like, yeah.
What are you thinking? It, you know, it's like all you have to do is just have one client who has, you know, is infected with SARS-CoV-2. And you pass that on to someone, right? You get infected as a hairdresser or a barber and... you go to the next house, so you infect. So one family infects you, and you infect the next one, and next one after that. It's like, don't do it.
Yeah, I don't know. Crazy. I don't know. So from what people you've talked to already for COVID and the research you've been doing, what are they saying? Predicting? What's the prediction for? I guess the two questions everyone wants to know is, when will we hit the apex, and then of course, when will this be over?
Huh. So I guess I've been more closely following the US side of it, and at least from what they are saying, it's going to get much, much worse, right? It's going to go up into like probably up to like 100 to 200,000 people infected, and it's going to come up to like thousands of deaths.
I think for the States, it's supposed to be several million infected and almost 200,000 dead is what the White House is saying.
Yeah, I think those are the numbers I heard. I hear some individual cities are doing better. I believe they may have reported that LA may have started flattening their curve. But again, I just think like that's totally meaningless, because if everything's like shit around you, you know, that may change in a heartbeat. You know, I guess we can start cursing now, but you know, it's going to change, right?
It's going to change everything. I think this is going to affect everything. This is going to be like, this is going to be something we all remember. It's going to be something that's going to affect culture, society, economies, countries in a way that we haven't seen since 9/11, probably. Since, you know, World War II, like these, it's going to have global dramatic impacts on our day-to-day lives. And that's not going to go away quickly.
No, it's not. And you're right. It's something that's going to change us forever, in ways we can predict and in ways we can't. You know, it'll be interesting to see.
I don't know. I hope soon. I hope we hit the apex soon, so I can start counting down the days back to. I don't think there's going back. There is a normal to go back to, but back to maybe less fear.
Yeah, I hope so too. But I think for it to be less fear, we need to be a lot more coordinated, at least in the U.S. side. And we're not that at all, right? So it's like every state is pretty much on their own, doing this their own thing. And the federal government isn't saying like, okay, you need to do this. Rather, they're leaving it to states' rights. And until we get to that point where we're all unified on this, you know, fear is going to be prevalent among the citizens. You know, it's unavoidable.
Yeah. I mean, the states has become the epicenter for the disease, hands down. But other countries, you know, are still really struggling. Spain is still struggling. The United Kingdom is about to get really impacted. They've started to hit their crisis of being lack of supplies, where the United States was a week and a half ago, almost 2 weeks ago now. Yeah, 2 weeks ago, where the White House, where the federal government in the United States was running out of supplies. The UK is now hitting that point of running out of supplies at the federal level. Spain's getting smashed. You know, Iran was one of the early big ones. Like, outside of China, Iran was the biggest early cases. I mean, I guess if I want to give the listeners to this podcast something to think about, because there's going to be news on, you can turn on your TV right now and you can get the latest stats for COVID-19 in your area, in your country. But I want to give you guys something to think about for COVID-19 in countries outside of the one you're living in. And that is going to be countries within the Middle East where, how do I say this politically, where they've recently had a huge war. Maybe it was the Americans, maybe it was ISIS, but areas of instability. So we talk about Iran being one of the big, big areas of COVID-19 outside, after China. Of course, the United States is number one now, but after, you know, pre that. And we look at cases that arrived in North America from Iran, and we start seeing a lot of these pickups of cases from Iran. But United States, Mexico, and Canada are not the largest transportation partners to Iran. Their biggest partners are, do you know this, David?
China.
It's Iraq and Syria.
Oh, okay.
So, wow. Yeah. So, yes, the cases that originally went into Iran did originally come from China, from a delegation of, not priests, but a religious sect, I think, some sort of religious grouping that went there. But Iran and Syria has a lot more travel with Iran for people, for moving people back and forth. But Iraq and Syria, post-wars and post-ISIS, don't have the healthcare infrastructure to do the kind of reporting that Iran is able to do. So it is very, very likely that Iraq and Syria have huge community outbreaks of this disease that isn't being reported in a way that you and I, living in our countries with healthcare systems and infrastructure that exist, for better or for worse, if I feel sick, you and I go to the hospital, we can get tested. And once we're tested, we have COVID-19 if we're positive. But in somewhere like Syria, that infrastructure doesn't exist right now. In a lot of places. I mean, some places it does. It does. But in some, a lot of places it doesn't. And you find out about the cases of COVID-19, not because there's symptoms and you get tested. You find out because someone died and there's an autopsy and you're like, oh, it was COVID-19. So that's a very different level of response. And I think, listen, I'm not going to tell people to like stop worrying about where they are for this stuff. But I think it's something to keep in mind that there are lots of countries that don't have the healthcare infrastructure that we do. And this is what the World Health Organization was so worried about originally with the when the outbreak in China, was not that could the United States cope, could the United Kingdom cope. It was, what about all these other countries that don't have the healthcare infrastructure to even try to cope? And so if you look at some of these reporting maps, if you look at some of these things for these countries, one of the reasons why places like Syria and Iraq have so low cases when they're surrounded by nations that have huge outbreaks is because they don't have the infrastructure to even test or report cases.
Yeah, and I was also reading, or may have heard it somewhere, that when you look at the death certificates, they're not going to say, okay, the person died of COVID-19. They might say they died of a respiratory illness, which is essentially what COVID-19 is.
Yeah.
So again, you know, that we need that data, right, to get an idea of, you know, what the problem is and what it looks like. But it's not being reported accurately, at least from my understanding of the situation.
It's being reported very inconsistently, too. Now, that's not necessarily the fault of anyone either. That is, you know, this is an ongoing crisis and things are changing all the time. And we're learning how to deal with this illness specifically and the specifics of this disease. We're learning more and more about all the time. We don't know everything about COVID-19 yet. But I remember at one point, I think it was March 23rd, the number of cases in Canada shot up by like 600 new cases when we were at that point in March. We were not anywhere near those kind of increases yet per day. But it shot up in one day because the province of Quebec changed how they were reporting. So before March 23rd, they were reporting the numbers of confirmed test kits that came back positive. After March 23rd, they were reporting the positive cases and the presumptive cases that hadn't tested positive yet, but they were like, this is probably COVID-19. So that changed. And again, that wasn't because of a policy decision. That wasn't because, you know, someone was doing something right or wrong. It was because this is an ongoing, changing, dynamic environment. We're learning as we go. And the protocols are changing daily, if not hourly, in some provinces, states, individual hospitals. I've already said that before. I just want to emphasize that again. And so sometimes it's not about doing it right or wrong, but learning as we go. And that makes it hard. That makes some of the reporting trickier, because everyone's reporting it a little bit differently, because there isn't really a gold standard right way that we can all sort of agree on that's useful and helpful.
Well, yeah, I think you're right. But again, I don't know. I guess to me it seems if there was some sort of, you know, cohesion, you know, in the sense that people are working together, you know, more uniformly, I guess we'd get better data. I don't know. I really don't know.
Yeah, and access to some of the equipment too, right? So like, there's different tests, right? So there's the antibody or antigen body blood test that some places have, but not all. Some places are doing PCR tests, which take longer, you know, in a perfect world, maybe like 36 hours, but with the backlog of tests, maybe a week for PCR tests in some high in cities that have big populations. And that can change too, because these tests, as you know, as a scientist, but maybe not all of our listeners know our benchtop scientists, different types of tests have different sensitivities. They have different false positive rates. They have different false negative rates. And so those protocols have to be different for regions, even within the same country, which have access to different types of testing facilities. It can be hard to take that data and try to add it all together, right? Because they all have different margins of error.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and you're totally right. But, you know, I guess we do what we can.
I guess I'm saying, I would say the optimistic message is, I think we're all trying to do the best we can, with the exception of some of our politicians who are self-serving. We've come back to this like four times in this last hour, but there is a lot of self-serving people, right? So like, there's a lot of reporting of numbers that are like, that are less accurate, but are the best that we can do in the situation. And then you have politicians who love to downplay the numbers to make it, because like it's some sort of numbers game they're trying to win, like it's golf and they want to get under par. If they're like, oh, we have less cases than you, like that is weird. Like living in an alternate reality during a global pandemic is how people die. That's what kills people.
Yeah, and that is, I guess, the same reason why it's so frustrating for me as well. It's that it has become a numbers game, and not to our benefit. It's like, oh, we want to get numbers low because it's an election year and we have to look good because we want to look good. We want to get reelected. And you're just thinking, here, but people are dying here. You know, like, save lives. That's why you're elected, you know, to handle something like this.
It's true. It's, you know, lead. I mean, you're a leader. You wanted to lead. Lead. Like, Jesus Christ. I mean, whatever your thing is.
You know, and I'm not saying, like, being a world leader is a simple job, but it's like that one job that you have to do. It's just one job. Just do it.
Yeah.
So is there anything you're optimistic about?
I think it's very easy to nitpick on some of the crazy, terrible things happening and getting very angry and frustrated at those government responses. I mean, even Joe Biden still to this day is saying that we don't need Medicare for all. I mean, that's...
Yeah, that is frustrating.
Because he thinks he's going to lose his support from the right wing that he's hoping to bring across. But there is a lot of good. And as we kind of also touched on, there's a lot of good happening that people don't see, that we don't talk about. People who are going to work, putting their lives at risk to help, you know, help maintain this thing. Like, we're talking about people who are creating masks, people who are making ventilators, people who are making hand sanitizers, you know, people who are not necessarily what you'd call a healthcare professional, but healthcare professionals couldn't do their jobs without them. And watching everyone come together, the communities, people reaching out to each other online. You see this, I'm seeing a lot of this on Twitter, seeing a lot on Facebook, a lot of people, you know, saying, hey, reach out, let's chat, help with social isolation, social isolation. And that human spirit of goodwill and helping, has been really positive. I can't remember the name of the phrase. There was that phrase, that term that was going around Canada with these groups. Do you remember what it was called?
No, I can't.
I think it was called, I don't want to get it wrong, caremongering. It's called caremongering. It's spread around the world, but it started in Canada. And it was like these people that were like, helped vulnerable people in Toronto. It's turned into a movement that spread across Canada, but started in Toronto, with Facebook groups, set up to, like, to serve communities and deliver things and move things around. So people at risk wouldn't have to, like, go out, and people with health complications wouldn't have to do the things that they have to do, like get groceries, and it allowed people to go and help and act in acts of kindness around the world. And so this caremongering thing has come out of this thing, and that's inspiring to see people really, and because, like, it's work they don't have to do. It is putting themselves individually at higher risk.
Yeah.
But to take away that risk for people who are at higher risk for greater complications. And that's been really great to see. I think there is optimism to be seen from this. It's going to get worse before it gets better. But I think, if anything, it's shown that people can be good.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. You know, it shows that innate human spirit, that deep down, I think we are good, that we have that ability to come together and do something for each other. So yeah, it shows that. And I hope we use that to change, at least to see what's broken in our systems and change
yes.
it.
Yes, you know, I think so too.
If there's one good thing that comes out of this, I hope that's the one good thing that comes out of it.
And I really hope so too. I really hope so. I hope there's change after this. I hope there's healthcare reform in countries that need it. I hope there's government reform in the countries that need it. I hope that all these people that have put people's lives at risk get voted out and they lose their jobs.
Yeah, same here.
So I guess we've talked about a lot of things in
we have the past good luck hour, good luck so. Editing this into some sort of episode that's cohesive and makes any sense.
I'll try to. So you wanted to say a few things about like your podcast and some things with other people.
Sure. This is a science communication podcast, so why not science communicate with me on some other platforms, people? So I am the host of two shows. One is a podcast called Mostly Science. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts, iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, whatevs. Check it out. It's a lot of fun. We learn new things all the time. I recommend the plant microbiome episode is a good one to start at, or the one on white abalone. I learned a lot doing that episode. I also host a YouTube series called Tumor Talk. Oh, actually, the Mostly Science Show. You can find us at facebook.com/mostlyscience. All the links are there. We're also mostlyscience.com. But join our Facebook group. It's a fun community. Good times. Anyway, second show. Cancer show. It's called Tumor Talk. It's a YouTube series. It's a video series. We're trying to helping cancer patients on their journey, help them navigate the healthcare system, navigate treatments, risks, fears, myths. We talk to patients about their journey, things they wish they had known ahead of time to help other patients and caregivers. So the target of the audience of our show is really both patients and people who currently have and have cancer. I try not to use the word fighting cancer. It's not a great message, because the idea that I don't like that term, but
right.
People who have cancer right now and going on their cancer journey, or family members, caregivers of people who are, you know, caring for someone on their cancer journey. There's a lot of helpful tips there. We talk to patients with patients' experiences. We talk to physicians about, taking away myths that people still think that like radiotherapy is like scary and dangerous, and it's not. It's safe and it's effective. We talk to cancer researchers like myself and some people I know. About upcoming therapies, clinical trials, state-of-the-art new things, look forward to hope in the future for treatments. And it's called Tumor Talk. I'll send you links. And I'm really excited about that project this year. That's a new project I'm doing in 2020. But yeah, still Mostly Science, facebook.com, Mostly Science, and Tumor Talk.
All right. That sounds good. I'll be sure to put all those links in the show notes. And for those of you that don't know, this is the second time Wes has been on this show. So you can check his previous episode where we actually talk about his work in cancer as well, and you know some of his science communication work. And it was nice having you. It's really great talking to you again.
It's always a pleasure, David. I enjoy your Facebook group that you run. Do you want to plug that Facebook group again for people? Where can we find you on Facebook?
So yeah, it's a small Facebook group. I didn't start the group. I sort of like inherited it, and it's sort of like to build a community of science communicators, because I think everyone does their own unique thing. And I think the way that they do it is both creative and impressive. You know, I'm always impressed at the intellect and the driving force behind each blog or each podcast or each YouTube. There's so much passion in what people do and passion in trying to get that message across. So it's a Facebook group on Facebook. It's a Facebook group. Science bloggers.
What's the name of the group? Science bloggers? Facebook.com/science bloggers?
It's Facebook/, yeah, I think it's like sci bloggers. That's the name that it ended up being. So you can check it out. As you know, if you're already listening to this, is the sciencebloggerspodcast.com. So we also have links there. We also have a Medium page that a Medium publication that I'm trying to grow to get those people who don't quite have blogs but are interested in science writing, so they can have that outlet to try something, you know, and hopefully that grows as well. So there's a lot in store for 2020. We'll see how that takes off.
If you are a science communicator and you found this podcast by searching through links on iTunes or Spotify, do go check out the Facebook group. It's facebook.com/groups/scibloggers. It's David, like you said, David inherited it. But it's a really good community, because like I started science blogging in 2004. But I transitioned into that because I was a tech person. I was a coder, I was a developer. And back in like 2001, when I had my first non-science blog, you really had to know how to code. Now, nowadays you don't, but people in these communities, you know, they come from different backgrounds. So if you had a question about your blog, you're like, oh, this WordPress thing isn't working, I don't know PHP. The community there helps. So it's like, I could jump in and be like, oh, I know PHP, here's how you fix this. You know, people are transitioning from blogs to YouTube to podcasting. There's podcasters already part of the groups. They can help you with mic recommendations. They can help you with setup recommendations. It's such a friendly community. So if you are a science communicator and you're not already part of this group and you're listening to this podcast right now, go join the group. It's a good community. Very friendly, very helpful. Go do that. David's great. Go support David. He's awesome.
Okay. Thank you for your kind words. As I said before, it was great having you again. I hope we do this again at some point in the future. Hopefully under more, we'll discuss something more pleasant, fun.
Of course. Always a pleasure, my friend. Thank you again for your hard work.
Okay, thank you, and have a good day.
Hey, everyone. I hope you enjoyed my talk with Wes and learned something from it. I hope that despite the frustration that Wes and I expressed sometimes during the course of this episode, that you still come out with a sense of optimism, as there are still a lot of good things happening, despite current world events. So yeah, be sure to check out Wes's podcast, Mostly Science, and his new YouTube channel, Tumor Talk. Follow him on social media, all links have been provided in the show description. And hey, while you're at it, like, share, leave a comment wherever you listen to this episode. Everything you do helps. But I'd also love to hear from anyone who listens to this episode or this podcast. And be safe and stay healthy if you can. I look forward to having you with me next time with a new guest and a new episode.